Because tonight's question, evil, the great accuser of God's existence. So the idea is I say a few things I have to say, and then I'll open up to what we have to say, hopefully keeping it on the topic of what I was saying, right? But if it's not, we take that on board as well. So I suppose the reality for all of us is that the question of evil is very real. And it's a particular issue for those of us who are believers in a God who is all-powerful and all-good. If you don't believe in God, it's not really a problem, I suppose, insofar as it's just part of our experience or part of our reality. And I'd be interested to know if we can say any more about it than that. But for us who do believe in a God, the question of evil is very real, and it's not just a question. And I suppose there's different ways we can look at this question of evil. We can look at it from a philosophical point of view, a theological point of view, and a very personal point of view. You can look at evil as a moral evil, or what we might call natural evil, in the sense of natural disasters. You can ask yourself about a child, a young child, who is dying in pain. That doesn't seem right. Or you can ask about an insect whose only reason, it seems to us anyway, to exist is the destruction of another insect. What's that all about? I stand here as a Dominican, right? So therefore I'm a follower of the teachings of St. Thomas Aquinas. And when St. Thomas Aquinas deals at the very beginning of his Summa Theologiae on the existence of God, utrum Deus sit, if there is a God, he brings forth two very basic objections to the existence of God. He brings it forth in probably one of his most famous questions. I call it 1, 2, 3. It's in the Prima Pars, it's the second question, and it's the third article. And in the answer that Thomas brings up, why this question is so important, he brings up the five ways, as we call it. The five ways he proves, philosophically, metaphysically, maybe, the existence of God. But what I'm interested in maybe tonight, initially anyway, is he presents two objections to the existence of God. And it's very strange, because if you read the rest of the Summa, as you know, the Summa's in three parts. Most of the other questions have three. Thomas always presents his argumentations. He brings in, he asks a question, if there's God. Then he presents three objections. And he usually brings up the best objections that are around at the time. And then he said, however, they said contra. And then he gives the response, the corpus of the article, and then he answers the questions. But very strangely, he only comes up with two objections to the existence of God. Objection number one, he says, it seems that God does not exist. Because if one of two contraries be infinite, the other would be altogether destroyed. But the word God means that he is infinite goodness. If therefore God existed, there would be no evil discoverable. But there is evil in the world, therefore God does not exist. That's Thomas's question. Put out there blankly. If you're dealing with good and evil, if something is all-powerful and all-good, and the other is evil and all-bad, one cannot exist. We all can see evil, therefore God does not exist. And his second objection, which is somewhat different, it says, further, it is superfluous to suppose that what can be accounted for by a few principles has been produced by many. But it seems that everything we see in the world can be accounted for by other principles, supposing God did not exist. For all natural things can be reduced to one principle, which is nature. And all voluntary things can be reduced to one principle, which is human reason, or will. Therefore, there is no need to suppose that God exists. So Thomas, in that second objection, is saying the ability of the natural sciences to explain everything in our experience without God. Nature works, and we can look at nature, and we can see the rules of nature, and we don't really need to posit a God. In some ways, his answer to that second objection is what will he proceed to with the five ways to prove philosophically that we can ultimately prove that we need something to exist on and of itself for the rest of us to be. He does make arguments in the five ways from being and contingent being. But that's not our question for tonight. We're not doing the five ways, in case you were looking for a tutorial on the five ways, okay? I want to return for a moment to the first objection. I want us to unpack this question of evil, rather than simply tell you what St. Thomas says about it. Firstly, I think we need to ask the question, why do we claim that if you believe in God, he has to be a good God? Fundamentally, I think it comes down to a very positive approach to being. It is good to be. And what's most fundamentally true about all of us in our experiences is I am. And none of us can actually deny the beauty of our own existence. I can remember sitting in one of these classrooms many moons ago with Cardinal Connell, as he was, Professor Connell, talking about this very point. You can't deny your own being. You might want to be the Pope, but you want to be the Pope. You don't want to be Francis Bergoglio. You might want to be the Prime Minister of Britain, but what you want is for you to be the Prime Minister of Britain. We may want things to be different or better, but we cannot want me not to be me. I cannot say, I want to be you, meaning I want not to be me. But what I actually think is, what's positive about you, that's what I want to be. And this very fundamental awareness of the importance of being, I think, of what is probably wrong in our modern world and so much of our interior suffering. How do I come to terms with me being me? Therefore, if this is true about us in our own experience, and we say that being is, because we experience that which is most fundamental to us, is being, and we claim that God is, and Thomas will say this is the truth of God, esse subsistence, that God is being in existence. Therefore, it must be the most perfect and good thing that can be, since the most perfect thing that can be is being. But if God is, and it is good, and our experiences of good, of being, is good, how can there be evil? And yet there is evil. We all experience it. But is it something to the, is it just simply the opposite of good? Equal to good? Or indeed, in our own experience, something more powerful than good. We naturally tend to picture evil as a thing, a black cloud, a dangerous storm called Ophelia, a disease, a force. But I think for Aquinas, this is very misleading, to think of evil as a thing. Because if God is the creator, and he would say in that question, article I mean, question three, that he has proven that God is, that things need to be created by someone who is already in being. Does he have to create evil? And if evil is a thing, then God would have had to create it. And therefore he is to blame for the existence of evil. But Aquinas, in a later question, 48 of the Prima Pars, and going on to 49, asks this question: what is evil? If we know what good is, or experience good, and the most fundamental good is myself in being, as my experience of it, what is evil? Now, very often, he says, opposites become known through the other. We know what darkness is in relationship to light. And to some extent, we do know what evil is in opposition to good. But goodness applies to all things that are in being. And so either they have been created by the Creator, or they have been created by fellow creatures, in the sense of not created, but come into being. But Thomas claims this cannot actually be said about evil, because he says evil isn't a thing. Evil, he says, is actually the absence of good. So it's not a thing that God has created. But what we call actually evil is the absence of a goodness that we know should be there, and it's not there. And so the question then becomes not that God created evil, but why did he allow evil to exist in that sense of non-being? So therefore, for Aquinas, evil is not a thing, an entity, but rather that absence of the goodness that we know should be there. It's a privation. And so therefore, even our awareness of evil has a primary awareness of goodness, because we know that something should be there that isn't there. Take the example. Blindness is the absence of sight. It's not a thing, even though we do talk about it as a thing. But it's not a thing. It's the absence of something that should be there. And yet, it's very real. I'm a priest. I come to terms with every day of my life. Evil is a reality in people's lives and in the world around about us. So it's not an illusion. Peter Crift, who has a very wonderful email, that was called those YouTubes and things, his book here is called Practical Theology. Crift says that evil is always a parasite. It can only exist in something good, as a parasite can live only on a host. And if we ever destroy the good it lives on, it will ultimately destroy itself. He says, fundamentally, evil can't win. Goodness is what wins out. And evil gets its power, to some extent, from the absence of goodness. So if therefore philosophically, according to Aquinas, we can say that evil is not a thing, but an absence of goodness, therefore he can say God is not the creator of evil. But that is all very nice. But we're still left with the problem of evil. It's still there. People are still sick and dying. Bad things are happening to good people. If I am told that I am dying of cancer, it isn't much good to me, maybe, to know that St. Thomas says, well, actually, that's a philosophical problem. and you just have a sickness that is not a good that should be there, it's not really much use to you. I don't think anybody takes a philosophical book to bed with themselves for comfort. Not, you know, you may do it and you may enjoy it and it may give you great joy and happiness. When push comes to shove, you want your teddy bear. Okay? And so the absence of goodness can feel very powerful. And at times, for us who are believers, God can feel very, very much away from us. And I have no doubt that many people have abandoned their faith because of the problem of evil than for any other reason. It is certainly the greatest test of our faith, those of us who believe. And the easy temptation is to say, I don't believe. And that's not just an intellectual objection. We feel it. We live it. Now, what Thomas says in the answer to the first question, in his objection, when they say that evil and good go, you know, if there's goodness and there's evil, therefore one of them can't, you can't have all something all good if there's evil, therefore God does not exist. Thomas says, quoting Augustine, by saying that God, since God is the highest good, he could not allow any evil to exist unless in his power and goodness he could bring evil out of the good. And this is where Thomas Aquinas basically signs off on the question of evil initially. This is the part of the infinite goodness of God that could allow evil to exist, knowing that he can bring good from it. And so we can say, therefore, that God allows physical imperfections, even in the natural order, for the sake of preserving the order of the universe. He allows he can tolerate sin in the human being because he knows he can preserve the goodness of the free will in the human being. So he allows moral evil in the interest of freedom because he knows it can come to good. And so in real sense, Thomas says God allows evil because it can preserve life and the moral character of intellectual beings. We are free. And I think that's Thomas's fundamental bottom line in the issue. Because we are free to accept or reject God. God did not make automatons. He did not make robots. He made free thinking human beings, which Thomas says God fundamentally knows are good and true. And at the basis of all our philosophy and our theology is goodness. And that God allows this goodness to prevail. And he doesn't destroy our freedom to reject him. So I can sit here and look and say, okay, God can bring good out of evil. And philosophically, as a believer, I suppose that's my bottom line. But I'll come back to that again. Because I do stand here as a believer. And the question of evil isn't simply a philosophical question that we can debate, agree with, disagree with. It's much more deep in that sense. Because even in our study of philosophy, philosophy presents us with the very real questions of life. Philosophy allows us the freedom to ask these questions and attempt an intellectual answer to them. But there are questions that are even deeper. what about being told I'm dying? What am I about when I go into a room of a child who is dying and the mother says to me, why, Father? Well, God can bring good out of evil, you know. I hate to tell you, she won't take much notice of your philosophical arguments. So to resolve the problem in practice, and not just in theory, and not just in thought, evil is a serious problem for thought. For Thomas says it can be used to disprove the very existence of God. It is even more of a problem in life, in my life, and in those I love. So I stand here tonight to you as a Christian who does believe in an all-loving, an all-powerful, an all-good God. And what's his answer to evil? It's not, initially it would seem, to destroy it. But what we see for us Christians is Jesus Christ. And he is God's answer to all of our questions. And so we must look to Christ. And yes, this is a theological perspective. But as I said, the question of evil is not simply a theological position. It's a theological question, it's a philosophical question, and it's a real question, a personal question for each and every one of us. But the theology of the Christian would be that God entered into the world and entered into evil. St. Paul says he became sin. Didn't mean he was a sinner. But when we look at Christ on the cross, and that's ultimately the Christian answer to the question of evil, that God entered into the world and took on evil, hatred, anger, jealousy, physical abuse, psychological torture, sickness, sadness, and ultimately the biggest question, death. And what does Jesus do? Does he shy away from it? Does he run away from it? No, he doesn't. He enters into it. And so for the Christian, Christ, God, enters into evil and destroys it. He brings love where there is none. And that's the ultimate question answer to the question for the Christian. That God, somebody once said, is like a bin man who comes right down and collects the garbage. He cleans it up, he heals, and he renews. So not that we get God off of the hook, but in the actual fact, Christ on the cross is God's hook to get evil. The cross, Jesus, love, mercy, this is the practical solution to evil. And we're invited not to be overcome by the negativity, but to give ourselves to the love that is present in Christ. And so when we suffer, evil is there. Pain is awful. But what do we do with it? If we unite it with Christ, it becomes life-giving. Without Christ, it's not life-giving. Pain united to Christ becomes redemptive. Pain, or evil, it has not the last word in Jesus. And we know that. And it's what we respond to. Humanity does not believe in its ultimate end is annihilation. We are meant to live and to be alive. But also, I think this whole question of evil, we have to take our own responsibility for it too. It's so easy to put all the blame on God. We can so often use God as our get-out clause, when in actual fact, we ourselves are the instigators of the evil before us. The origin of evil is not the Creator, but the creatures freely choosing sinful and selfish ways of life. Take away all of our sin and selfishness, you'd have a very different world. We don't need to blame God. God sometimes is the easy answer. We never look at ourselves, and we never look at the way which I can perpetrate evil myself. How many of the difficulties that we call evil are self-afflicted? Now, there is no doubt, I think, that there is some connection between sin and evil, even in the physical world. Because we are living beings who are physical and spiritual, and our physical reality does impinge on our spiritual reality. And so there is a connection between evil and sin. Maybe even between spiritual sin and physical evil. And so if we look at our own selves and the evil that we see about us, we have to ask honestly about ourselves as much as we do about God. And in the face of it, what are we left with? How do we face it in our own selves? The all-powerful God gave us a share in his power as creatures to choose freely. Would we have preferred not to have been made? No, we wouldn't. Would we have preferred to have been robots? No, we wouldn't. We are human beings. And that's the reality. And our story is real. In my life as a priest, very often, one of the most important questions I'm asked by people is, why? Why, Father? Why did God let this happen? Why? And lots of times I have no answer. I have answers. But what kind of an answer do you give to a parent whose child is dying? What sort of answer could you give to, say, just the other day with this hurricane? Two women are in a car, a tree falls down, it kills one and leaves the other. Why? It's physical reality. You don't have to blame God for it. It's part of the reality of what happens in this free world. But I do think in the end, God does let us know a lot. He has lifted the curtain on the problem of evil with Christ. God has entered our world and faced down evil. He hasn't run away from evil. He has loved it. Loved us in it, I should say. He has loved us in it. And in his all-wise and loving plan, his desire is to bring about the greatest good, the salvation of the world from sin and suffering. Ultimately, I think, without God, evil remains unconquered and unconquerable. Evil is not, I would say, the great accuser of God's existence. But our belief in God is our only hope in the face of the evil that we face. Without God and our belief in goodness, we would have nothing to live for. Goodness rebels against evil. And that's why we can ask this question. Is evil the great accuser of God? Because goodness rebels against the face of evil. And our only answer is God's answer, which is love. Evil wants us to believe that God doesn't exist. Since then, evil can go on existing. But God allows us to say that evil does exist. But we can face it down. And it is not the last. Evil doesn't accuse God, I would say. I would say God is the only answer to evil. Without evil, God wins. But deep down, the goodness of each of us refuses to accept this is true. And I say that's why we are here tonight. Because each of us knows deep down, evil cannot be the answer. The evil we see about us cannot be the only reality or the deepest truth of reality. Yes, we can answer the question. A good God, an all-powerful God, has permitted evil, which is not a thing, but the absence of a goodness. And so in the end, what wins out is goodness. If you want to call the goodness God, fine. But I do think we as believers, as philosophers, as human beings, we can never allow evil to win. Because when we give up in the face of evil, we give up being human beings who are good. And indeed, as the scripture says, indeed, they are very good. So there you are now. There you are. You're still awake.
Okay, so you were talking about evil.
Yes.
Right after you talked about Jesus being the garbage man, you
said
that evil united to Christ, or pain. You said pain united to Christ becomes redemptive.
Yes.
And that was kind of before you talked about the relationship between evil and pain. And
evil and Marta and
natural
evil.
Yeah.
How do you unite pain to evil? How do I unite pain to evil? Is it in our experience? I'm a man. Now women are different. He can put up with pain. We men can't. I mean that's the reality. We can't do pain, right? I mean you can have all the thoughts you like in the world. You get a pain in your tooth. I don't care about St. Thomas. I don't care about anybody else. I want this tooth fixed, okay? So pain isn't good, you know? And what use is it? Now you could say sometimes pain is good. Why? Because if I have a pain in my head, I need to get it checked out. So in actual fact, pain sometimes can be a very good thing to have. But I'm just talking about the useless, without any reason for suffering and pain we see in the world. There's no answer to it. However, what I'm saying is that when we unite with Christ and his offering to his Father, it can become redemptive. And people can sometimes say to you, and just again, in a very ordinary way, oh, you know, I went through that crisis in my life and I came out a much better person at the end. So in that sense, it can be redemptive, okay? Now, the question is there somewhere along the line, and I don't want to open this up in 5 minutes because it's a very complicated question. You know, is there a real connection between sinfulness and physical reality of problems in the world?
Okay, but in the case of having pain, how is it that you unite that to Christ and it becomes redemptive, co-redemptive?
By you, it's a whole attitude of your own life. It's your own freedom. For instance, what freed us from, say, Christ's suffering on the cross was Christ's attitude, basically. He loved in the midst of suffering. And he lived in the midst of death. And so, my pain offered to Christ for other people, that redemptive sense, there's a reason for it then. It's not just a negativity now. I'm offering, and we see this in a long tradition of Christian spirituality, that we can actually unite ourselves with Christ. And St. Paul is that very interesting line, you know, making up what's lacking in the sufferings of Christ. Objectively speaking, of course, there's nothing absent in the sufferings of Christ. But because he has united himself with us so, so intimately in baptism, that we are part of the story of Christ. And so my suffering, filled with love, and St. Thomas Aquinas is very strong on that, you know, it's the love with which you do it is the redemptiveness of it. It's not just putting up with pain for the sake of pain. You know, that to be a Christian, you have to be depressed all the time. I don't believe in that. Needless to say, look at the size of me. Right? Right? But when you, in your love, you're united with Christ, it takes on a different reality. It doesn't take away the pain, by the way. I've often people say to me, oh, you know, if I was very holy, I wouldn't be given out about the fact I have a pain. Of course you would. The fact that you're holy doesn't mean take the pain away. It's the fact that the pain is now being offered in love to Christ as part of his story in the redemption of the world.